Right, so welcome. It's a pleasure to see you here. Thank you for coming. My name is John Shellcraft. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Government. I work on history and politics and labour and migration and social movements in the Middle East. Today we are here to discuss the paper of Professor Abdulhadi Khalaf, who we're very happy to welcome. It's one of the activities we do in this research network. It's called Social Movements and Popular Mobilization in the Middle East and North Africa. It's kindly funded and sponsored by the Middle East Center and the Government Department at LSE. We have a seminar series with a number of meetings every year. This is one of them. We aim for quality rather than quantity. I think we have four or five meetings this year. So this is one of those. Most of us have had an opportunity to read the paper that's been circulated in advance. So the idea of the seminar is it's quite interactive. We'll get to discuss, not simply to pose questions. And we also aim to give the professor a run for his money in terms of trying to, you know, push and understand and take forward and the arguments. And we hope also the seminar will result in a published paper that will then be circulated. So we'll have 10 to 15 minutes of presentation from the professor, then I'll speak for about 10 minutes by way of being a discussant and trying to connect the paper to some of the themes of the series. Then the discussion from the floor, if you'd be kind enough to silence your phones. And I'd like to say what a pleasure it is to have Professor Abdulhadi Khalaf here. He's a professor of sociology at Lund University in Sweden. He's a scholar, he's also a politician, he's worked on labour and state building and political participation. He's done very serious and detailed work, especially on some of the things I've seen about grappling with power relations, transformation, reproduction, and trying to situate as well activism in that context. And one notable recent edited volume that is a 2015 publication called Transit States that Abdulhadi Khalaf has co-edited with Adam Hania and Omar Shahebi, which is also very well worth having a look. So if you would like to tweet about this event, then you can use hashtag LSE Khalaf. And I'm responsible for timekeeping, but with that, let's give the professor a welcome to LSE.
Thank you, John, for this kind presentation. Thank you for coming. When I received the invitation, it was rather late, but when I received it, I was enticed, attracted by the offer that I use writing this paper as a trial of a particular theme, particular ideas that I have on the Bahraini uprising. And this was really exciting because what I have written in the paper are exactly this, trial ideas. I was not interested in writing about the Intifada as such. There are now several books. Most recent one is a book by Shihabi and Jones on the Bahraini uprising. It is worth reading. It is worth looking into. It is edited the volume. What I was more interested in is why did the uprising happen? Why did it happen in Bahrain? In spite of all what we know about the Golden Bargain, about the rentier state capacities, all what we know about the capacity of the state, irrepressive capacity of the state. And in spite of what we know, that in October, November 2010, the opposition in Bahrain has scored massive victory, massive electoral victory. And the mainstream opposition force, that is Al-Wefaq, managed to build the largest bloc in the parliament, 18 MPs among the within the among the 40 members of parliament. The reasons to look for is unlike that in Egypt, unlike that those in Tunisia, or for that matter Libya and Syria and Yemen. There were a slogan that is repeated by tourist industry in Bahrain, Al-Bahrain Ghair. Bahrain is different. That is to say, we are different than, say, Kuwait. We offer something else. And this was used by politicians of all sorts in Bahrain after the Tunisian and Egyptian uprising, Al-Bahrain Ghair. Bahrain is different. One cannot compare it, people said, with Tunisia or to Egypt. We are different. And there are several reasons for that, of course. One basic difference is that in Bahrain, all relevant political actors were in agreement that the situation is good enough. Mainstream opposition and the regime, the royal family, were in general agreement, at least in November 2010, that the situation was satisfactory and can live with it. Both the regime and the mainstream opposition forces, I suggest, have missed those currents that develop under the surface, currents that have proved to be very important for the eruption of the uprising on 14th February, and for the trajectory it took, and for its ability to survive even after the Saudi incursion in March 2011. Two important political actors should have been neglected by the regime and by the mainstream opposition, and of course by most of us, including myself. Namely, the first are those what can be grouped as radical flanks. Those marginalized veterans of the anti-regime struggle, those veterans of the democratic struggles from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and particularly veterans of the 1992-1999 Intifada in Bahrain. It's a long intifada that raised the slogan of rebuilding the constitutional country, a country that offers equal citizenship rights to all its citizens. These veterans were, some of these veterans were marginalized, pushed aside during the years 2001 and up to 2010. The neglect was because they have some of these veterans protested, they objected to the type of agreement, type of cooperation between opposition forces, mainstream opposition forces, and the regime. They objected also to the general acceptance of the mistakes, or what I call the blunders of the king. blunders that have that have accumulated to make the country undemocratic, to make the country very authoritarian, and to bring the country back to what it was in the 90s, and in many cases even further to the 50s, when we were under British protection and British administration. The second political actor that was neglected are what I also call, borrowing from literature on social movement, are the contingent accelerators. These are the young activists who lack the credibility, who lack the credential of being veterans or have the following among social following or political following, but they are activists. They are ready to work. They are savvy with social media, and they are also well connected with their peers outside Bahrain, particularly in Tunisia, in Egypt, and elsewhere. These two political actors were neglected, and many thought that their activities were doomed to failure. They might initiate an action. They might initiate some activity, but theirs will be doomed. They will probably take an hour or 2 hours, or probably a couple of days, but they will end in failure. The idea is not taken out of nowhere. We have a history of failed movement. Collective actions in Bahrain come and go, and they usually survive for a few hours, sometimes for a few days, even for weeks. But in the end, the regime, the ruling family, the king, manages to mobilize enough repression and enough support from the from Bahrain's notables to bring the country back to calm and to enforce order. It has been repeated. We have cycles of long periods of uprising that goes back to 1950s, 1954 to 1956, then 1965, 1972, and then we have the 1980-81, then we have the longest one, 1992 to 1999. So the prediction that this, again in 2011 will fail was not unrealistic. What was unrealistic is that the regime and mainstream opposition did not see what was more or less written on the walls. It was literally written on the walls, because these young activists, together on their own, and the radical flanks on their own, were actually proposing that the Day of Rage will be launched on the 14th of February. And many of them, I talked to some, I talked to some even before, and their calculation was that even if it is for a few hours, even if we are only 10 or half or a few dozens, we are going to discredit the political process that has been launched by the regime and was in cooperation with mainstream opposition. Now, I am using the two at least one ambiguous definition of radical flank. Within social movement, the radical flank is very understudied. We have very few studies that focus on them. I had the pleasure last week to speak with one of the experts, preparing myself for this, with one of the experts on radical flanks. She is Donatella della Porta. And we have very few studies that exist, except on the leftist in Europe or the civil rights in the United States. But there must be so many examples, so many varied examples to see how radical flanks in social movement influence social movements' trajectory, social movements' life, and even its the level of participation and its future. Look at if we look back into, say, the Palestinian first Intifada of 86, then we have Hamas as an example of the radical flank that has been not studied as such. Now, there is a problem with the radical flank: is what is radical in the radical? And here I have, of course, a problem in Bahrain, as like others have in their case studies. Radical flank can be anything, God saves us from being radicalized now, because radicalized is getting so dirty word. But in this case, radical flank might be also, we have to look at radical flank, those actors that go beyond mainstream activism, either in their slogans or in their strategies. It is not necessarily that they are extreme. Radical here is not synonymous with being extreme. So but framing radical flanks or framing radicalism as being extreme is a fault, is a mistake that we social scientists do without thinking, while regimes and security forces do deliberately. We should avoid that. But if in Bahrain, at least, the radical flanks that I'm talking about are radical because the situation has moved, the political process has moved mainstream opposition from being moderate to being very conservative. Let me stop here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's very interesting and provocative, and of course this paper does contain within it this, I mean, it is an unusual and provocative thesis, because what you've said is that, I mean, by saying that Bahrain is different, this is not part of a wider cycle of contention, but something new, the declaration of the end of a paradigm of rentierism. That's quite a provocative thesis in the context of the way readings of the Arab uprisings have gone since 2011, because there's often kind of different sorts of backpedalings from earlier assessments that stress novelty, innovation, dramatic surprise. But you're here telling us that, you know, far from wanting to put the Bahraini uprising back in some perspective and make it seem less significant, which is a direction that a number of people have gone in with regard to uprisings in other countries, you're saying somehow it's something dramatically new in terms of signaling the end of or signalling the bankruptcy of a certain kind of rentierism. So that is that's provocative. I definitely would like to know what the in more detail to sort of specify how and why that is the case. Look, I mean, I wonder about whether drawing on Saudi and UAE military intervention to crush the uprising, is that a break with the pre-existing paradigm? I mean, perhaps in terms of troop movements, but in terms of, I mean, protection seeking in some way, going, I mean, the British and others, the support of external powers, never seems that far away from the model of rentierism. So I wonder about that. I found tremendously suggestive and interesting this notion of the king's follies, which I understood to mean that King Hamad and others high up in the political establishment have failed to implement the at least some of the potential or promises of that hung around 2000 and 2002, and instead they've repeatedly rode back on the existence of meaningful representative institutions, and that's a suggestive thesis. I assume you mean that does it mean that these are only follies insofar as, I mean, that this kind of politics of hollowed out, promised but not delivered liberal or hybrid democracy, or a failure over democracy, is the argument that this could work if rentier politics was working, in the sense of redistribution and provisionism. It could be matched to a kind of truncated but failed liberal democracy. But now that this rentierism is no longer working, these failures to lead into deeper forms of liberal democracy are thus folly in this sense. They're blunders, because they will end up provoking more radical forms of mobilization. I wondered if I understood that right. But it's interesting to me, this notion of the folly or the blunder, because it seems to imply, you know, there's not some inherent strategic logic to what the ruling family are doing. There are alternate paths that are open to them, but they haven't done them, and that's a blunder, because had they done them, there might have been some way to continue to reform, to not end up with unresolved uprisings and unresolved crises. And I suppose that idea of radicalism, I like the fact you mentioned that we shouldn't cheapen it by thinking in terms of, you know, the ways in which Homeland Security think of it, but instead, I mean, the idea often had this notion of going to the root of the matter. If the radicals are those who go to, they understand that there is a fundamental problem with truncated democracy plus failed rentierism, and that there's a fundamental problem that must be addressed, then those are the radicals, as it were. I wonder if something of that sort, I mean, you know, recalling the, you know, Marx's notion of what a radical was, someone who would go to the root of the matter and understand the problem. But so maybe that has something to do with, I mean, yeah, radical flanks, as you say, quite understudied in the Middle East and North Africa. One thing I wanted to ask you about, and is that, I mean, and this goes back to what I mentioned at the beginning, like Maha Abdurrahman came here and gave a paper in this series called In Praise of Organization. And it was part of a rowing back on the initial excitement and promise of leaderless form of movements. And your contingent accelerators are leaderless. They're decentralized, they're a bit diverse, they're networked, they cross borders, they use social media. You put some emphasis on their importance. Maha Abdurrahman has given us a paper called In Praise of Organization, which says, look, this was all very well for putting for a form of for a capacity to degrade a form of authoritarian power. But what it was not good for was then rebuilding after the dictator had fallen and engaging in the kinds of negotiations and politics that accompany new or incipient forms of liberal democracy. And we also had Joel Beinin here comparing Tunisia with Egypt and saying, well, in Tunisia you had these quite well organized forces, you know, from underneath the top leadership of the UGTT downwards, the main trade union in Tunisia, which were able to act in an organized way to then really work to drive through to hold on to certain rights that were promised in the uprising in Tunisia. And then, and so it's refreshing and interesting to hear that, you know, leaderless movements are not yet being completely written off in this paper, although it doesn't, you don't go into a huge amount of detail, but you do suggest that they have this role as contingent accelerators. And that's interesting because maybe the context here is a little bit different, because you have Wefaat, the organized an opposition which wins electoral victories. It's quite different to what happens in Egypt in 2010, where the Muslim Brotherhood is shut out of the elections of 2010. And it has reasons, therefore, to take to the streets in early January 2011. Whereas in Bahrain, it seems, from this paper, that Wefaat didn't have those reasons as an organized body that was able to, it found a place in the state in one way or another. And then, and therefore, the sort of requirement for contingent accelerators and radical flanks who were veterans of older struggles. But it's interesting because some people, again, going back to, you're proposing a kind of a novelty for Bahrain, because there's a tendency to think, well, Tunisia is the paradigm, and others were sort of weak or deviant or failed echoes of the Tunisian experience. They took that model, they tried it, and then it went in all sorts of directions that weren't as fruitful, weren't as successful. Look what happened in Syria, it ended up in civil war. Look what happened in Egypt, there was one coup which, you know, maybe opened some doors. Then there was another coup, 3rd of July 2013, which led to the revamped security state and the annihilation of the liberal opposition and everything else. But you're saying, that's interesting, that you, in your case, the Bahrain example, it's not a sort of pale echo of the Tunisian paradigm. It's sort of something that announces something new on the Arabian Peninsula. And I suppose maybe that means that the exposure of the military, as it were, but from Saudi Arabia, the use of it exposes the violence that's now required to shore up a failing rentier bargain. So that's sort of interesting. I wonder if that's what you mean. And I wonder if that sort of interpretation could be sustained in some way. I mean, and of course there's this thing that's striking about Bahrain, is that following the repression, you don't have a militarization. You know, what happens to protest tactics actually after the repression? Because in Syria, you have people start to pick up arms, other people say, no, it's pointless trying to carry on with institutional disruption and occupations of squares. In Bahrain, do protest tactics have a different sort of pattern? What sort of have happened? And one final thing. I'm glad that this paper pays attention in I think a sort of a historical and sociological way to, I mean, the antecedents to 2011, and especially that history in the 2000s. I mean, so much of social movements theory is very weak at specifying historical backgrounds, critical histories, especially this terrible nervousness around path dependency, and you know. So I appreciated that, but I suppose it must involve all sorts of definitions of the political field. What's desirable? And again, you said, what's radical in radical? Is there a political program? Because this is another criticism of the you know, the horizontalist youth, is that what is their substantive political program? What sort of Bahrain do activists want to see? And is it just, okay, rentierism as is, but with better functioning liberal democratic institutions and an end to this systematic discrimination against Shia and others? Or what is the vision? What's the concrete vision? So that's another set of questions. So anyway, that's a set of questions and provocations, and but also appreciations of this that's an interesting and provocative paper that you've given us to look into. So thank you. But perhaps if you'd like to, you're allowed to respond, and then we can open up the floor.
It is not a response. Mm. Response to what you said. I will try to clarify. I think why I chose Royal Follies is simply because Hamed in 2000, from 2000 to 2002. 2 years, he could do anything almost. He can ask the opposition to sign on anything. Most of opposition groups would have accepted. In fact, the Communist Party of Bahrain has issued a communique. It is the unity of the king's will with the people's will. The new constitution was, according to the to this leftist organization, was a unity of the royal and people's will. So the king had almost everything for him, everything going for him in those 2 years. I think those critical voices were very few and far between, and they were very isolated and had small minor places that they can minor followers too. But he missed his chances. He missed his chances because he simply thought that he will solve his Samuel P. Huntington called the king's dilemma. So how much reforms a king reformer can do without alienating his own people, and how much reforms he can give without risking that opposition will demand even more. This dilemma, the king tried to solve it by offering makrama. The makrama is a key. King Hamad has alleviated this concept of makrama to the disbursement of gratuities in forms of money or positions or titles to political leaders, so to social notables. He alleviated it through an art. The notable became notables became an expanded but diluted social force in the country. This is one effect. The second he has from he did not even consult any of the opposition groups that were ready to sign on anything he offers. So he took several steps that were unnecessary. He could have consulted this and that, but he did not. The reason, probably some students of Bahrain suggest that there is radicals within his family. They are the old guards. There is all guys within the ruling family. I don't follow that. I don't accept that. I see no reason to accept it. There is no empirical evidence. There are no proof that there are too many flanks within or factions within the family, and they are competing. The king simply thought that now he has the field leveled for himself, and he didn't care about the rest of the opposition. He humiliated the mainstream opposition more than they deserve, because they were willing to sign on. The only one thing he let go for the opposition, the family law. When the Shia clerics protested against the family law, that is in accordance with the Sidao agreement, he conceded that family law in Bahrain will apply only to the Sunni section. The Shia's women will not be subject to that law. This is, he still respects that. he did not, this is the only concessions he has given. And this is understandable for him. The ruling family since 1869, according to my reading, to my what I have written in my unfinished business, a book I written in year 2000, the ruling family relies on cooperation of the clerical establishments, Sunni establishment and Shia establishment. Without consent, without cooperation from senior clerics from both sides, from Shia and Sunni, ruling family had trouble. So they do, the ruling family always do that. A concession on women's rights were part of those. But for the rest of the people, follies continue. One of the follies is the his inability put to account the torturers in his in the security services, which I mentioned in the paper. Now the role of Makrama came to an end. As a student of as an observer, you could have an inkling that rentier state is failing or Makrama politics is are failing on the 12th and 13th of February, 2 days before the Intifada in February, 2011. The king announced that each family will be given 1,000 dinar, $360, okay. $80. Each family, of course, it is good money. You will get it for doing nothing. Very few went to collect it. Then you knew that the debt was somewhere assigned. I'm not talking about Shia villagers here or Shia disgruntled workers here or there. I'm talking about the majority of people. Sunni, Shia, from the up north to the deep south, whatever, the Bahrain is too small, but it's still from all over the place, people did not go to collect them. So that was a small, you could have an indication that something is wrong with that policy. Still he continued it. Now, you raise an important thing about leaderlessness. Of course, I have been doing organization. I've been organized since I was 14, so I have a problem with questioning organization. I don't. What the contingent accelerators were important because of their leaderlessness. La lil qiyad al markaziya, no to central leadership. Networks had their different leaders or different sets, but why the slogan "No to central leadership"? Because main opposition group have framed politics that it should be centralized. Al-Wifaq should be, and it is not Al-Wifaq political leaders; it is Al-Wifaq religious mentor. That is Sheikh Isa Qasim. The person was the leader. So this was a common cause between both the young accelerators, I call them, and the radical flanks. Radical flanks, say like Shemir, like Haq, or like Wafa, or others, would not have a room to maneuver, to act, if they accepted the centralized leadership. They have to question centralized leadership. And that was the why leaderlessness was necessary, because then it allows the logic of it. It will allow for innovative policies, measures, and tactics, etc. Now, things that the cooperation between these younger groups, of course, you know now, you know any number of people you you talk to will say that they were active in they were members of these young activist groups. Of course, they cannot be all of them are members of that, but because of being leaderless and because of Bahrain the history. Now I'm reading a book of a draft book somebody is written about 1950s about a small organization. Each village more or less produced an Arab nationalist movement. So it's small villages everywhere, and I thought I knew the details of that type of policy of that period, but I was surprised of how many small networks. And this is what happened also pre 14th February 2011. There were so many networks that were ready. I did not take up roles of some important people like, say, Nabil Rajab, like the Bahrain Center of Human Rights, because they also mobilized for 14th for the Day of Rage in 2011. But I didn't take them up because they didn't have that political. They were doing it to mobilize, not to within a program. Your last question, which I am not able to really answer, what is the program? Of course, we have the political programs for several organizations in Bahrain, but they are not those type of programs that you will look. That you will see what is the end game aside from the general meaning that constitutional country equal citizenship, etc. But how that those are operationalized? We have even the slogan that the everyone in Bahrain in the opposition accept. That is the creating a civil state. Even religious, even clerics raise that, but what is the content of that, what is the substance of civil state, is it varies according to the speakers.
Okay, terrific. So, the floor will now open, and there may be quite a few people wanting to speak, so we'll definitely, I'll take quite a series of interventions, I think, if that's agreeable, and if you speak up, because this is being recorded, so we would like to speak loud and clear, and also maybe say who you are and your institutional affiliation, so the floor is open.
Could I kick off? My name is Tom Thompson, and ask about the leaderless uprising. Is there any role for Iran in this? Is there any influence for Iran? Because Iran hasn't been even mentioned in this. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Okay, maybe we'll take a few, if that's okay. So, thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much. Just a question about how.
Just say who you are.
Oh, sorry. My name is Said Shihabi. I'm from Bahrain also. The role of the outside forces, in addition to the Saudi and the Emirati intervention in mid March 2011, how much did the British act and support the regime to suppress the uprising?
Very concise, the questions so far. Maybe okay. We could still... Okay, let me mix the two.
In social movement studies, the political opportunities can be influenced. by external actors. The political opportunities are not only internal result of internal dynamics, but external actors, external influences are quite important at times. What has happened in Bahrain was that throughout, from year 2000, from the inception of the royal reforms until 2011, until 2000, and continued a bit after that, British and American. British and American, and somehow also French embassies were actively engaged in convincing mainstream opposition that take control of your young and your radicals, we will fix it. The king is true to his promises. And as it were, the main opposition groups, particularly Al-Wifaq, believed that, trusted the British and the Americans and the French assurances. And there were many occasions that the rank and file of the opposition groups were near revolt, and they were they were quietened by their leaders because some promises are there. Iran at the time of the Iran has always been interested in Bahrain. This is part of our geography, part of our history. This is as it is in Saudi Arabia. But in the during those years, after 2009, Iran was not interested in making trouble to itself in Bahrain. Bassiouni, for example, Bassiouni report that the king has ordered, and it was written more or less for the king, for the king's ears. Still, Bassiouni did not said specifically, we have not been offered any evidence that of Iranian role in the uprising. But that is specific. But later the government said, yes, we didn't give him the evidence. Yeah. But that is another thing. But the report is full, many pages, but this exact word were there. Iranian, of course, the Iran as a country must have its interest in regional interest vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain is soft belly for both Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now, the British, unfortunately, the British has now, it is not on the Intifada or on appeasing placating main opposition groups, but the British have history of a legacy of misbehavior, British administration, misbehavior in Bahrain will go back to 1926 until now. And a British minister in the parliament said, I don't know whose name it, but he said that we are assisting Bahrain in reforming its police force. I get frightened because the same British policeman was in charge of torturing me in the 70s. So if that type of assistance will be repeated, then we are in bad shape. But.
So has it been repeated?
It should be. It is, because now we have our police, the Bahraini police, is trained by experts from all over the world, but Britain has a history, has a higher hand. I don't know the details. So. Mm-hmm.
And might that play into your answer to the question from over there, how would the regime react to another uprising?
The regime has always reacted with the using to quote Michael Mann's here, both capacities of the states, the infrastructural capacity and the repressive capacity. So he build hospitals, build roads, and disperse makramas, or bring more police. He did. Now the regime has very advanced security forces now compared with what it was in 2011. No, my impression is that the coming one is not another episode like we have been seeing, we have experienced in the past. This is what will appear might be a different one. I don't know how, but I've written a book called Civil Resistance. Probably they learn something from it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Professor, for what you had mentioned. I mean, agree and disagree on some what you said. I don't get whom you mean by radicals in Bahrain, because whoever have expressed his opinion have not used any kind of threat by the mean of terrorism or anything like that, that front. So it's just an expression of an opinion, of an idea on how the political reform should take place in Bahrain, a real structural political reform. And at the other front, the question is, looking to the future, what do you see the way forward in order for another way of political movement or movement by the citizens of Bahrain to be successful on changing a meaningful change in the political structure?
Easy questions.
Yeah. Let me take the easy answer.
Yeah,
the last question I cannot answer. I don't know how. I don't know how things will evolve. But no, radical flank. Radical. I don't mean radical as extreme. Radical for any regime is anyone that criticizes, at least in our region, anyone who criticizes the state or state authorities or persons will be considered radical. And in Bahrain, the radicals that I call, I mentioned Wafa as radical, I mentioned as an organization, I mentioned Haq as radical. Compared to the because now we'll get into definitions of radicals, but one thing, these people are radical relative to the extremely moderate, or as in Bahrain, those who are conciliatory, those who are critical.
I think this is just a framing of how they have been positioned, but in reality they are not.
All right. So somebody over here.
I think it's radical in Bahrain is defined, realistically is defined to whoever is objecting 2002 and is not willing to play by the rules set up by 2002. That's what's radical in Bahrain. Mm-hmm. You don't need to hold anything in your hand as a weapon to be considered radical. Mm-hmm. On the other point which you say, like, if you just express your opinion peacefully, you don't actually, you know, form any kind of a material threat, then where's the Brian Cherry?
Okay. All right.
You voice your opinion by hand. I mean, any opinion that is, you know, where you actually touch on the actual matter, I mean, even when you're going ahead.
Yeah. The prison.
All right. Yes.
My question is not to her question. This Muharram was the first time that the Bahraini government puts down the Muharram flags. What does that signal? Does it signal that the government is so desperate and this is like one tiny act of resistance against the people, or is it like a start of a new treatment for the Shia majority?
Mm. Okay.
Alat Shahabi, also from Bahrain.
in your theory of the radical flank, there's two effects of the radical flank, right? The influence they have on the moderates and making them less moderate, but also the influence on the regime and making it putting more pressure in any possible negotiation. And so balancing the needs of both, because the moderates were getting closer to the regime and so on. What's the outcome being on the less extreme moderate? We see world now, the position, have they been forced into a less compromising position, especially that we see the heads of Wafaq? I don't want to be unfair to Wafaq in the sense that they seem to have stood their ground, at least despite having wanted to kind of negotiate with the regime. So the head of Ali Salman and its senior leadership are now in prison, and people like Ibrahim Sharif, who are considered kind of moderate, are now in prison. So the radical flanks have closed ranks of the opposition almost, and does that mean they have to actually succeed to some extent in at least holding that position firm vis-a-vis the state?
Right. Okay, perhaps let's have one more before we go back.
John Kaparin, Aga Khan University. Thank you, Abdul Hadi. I really appreciated your account of what actually happened in the sociology of the various parts of the uprising. When you recount the retrospective, you recount the retrospective in terms of a failed institutional reform, which in your narrative seems to have generated the kind of scenario that we see in 2011. And then you tell us that that kind of scenario has somehow changed. Now, I wonder if that also means that there's no room for constitutional accommodation in with this new scenario. That is one, that this pulverization of the non-regime positions, can we think of a way of actually putting that back into a constitutional framework? Would that make any sense, or is that completely out of the question?
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. And just if as well you do, will you say whether 2002 and those who accepted the what was offered in 2002 compared to those who said no to it, that is that very important, as was implied from the floor? I mean, just as well to...
Yes. Firstly, let me address Muharram. Mm. Muharram has been always, since the 50s, at least in my memory, since I was young boy. Muharram was a time where political organization challenged the regime. It was in the 50s, it was by the National Union, National Union Committee. It was used slogans for Muharram. It was, even the Communist Party has used Muharram during the 50 until, from the 55 until 1963, using Muharram to raise a slogan. So the Muharram is a time where political organizations use the gathering to mobilize, to express their opinions and to reach out to people. The rituals of putting signs of Muharram flags, etc., sometimes expands beyond the perimeters that were accepted by the regime. So they usually, throughout the year, they usually push them back to the neighborhoods where the matams or where the rituals are held. This has been the practice for decades. In recent years, there has been another element, especially the new element is with the Salafi introduction in the military and in the security forces. So the Salafists, or those who come with the Saudi religious education, these people act beyond their mandate even. They push even further. So part of it. Part of it might be sanctioned by the regime because they want to impose control, but also be owned by individual officers and soldiers. No, I don't see that what happened during the last 2 years. I have seen it 3 years ago, 6 years ago when I was there. I saw that the people tearing banners from around streets near the Catholic Church, etc. But nothing serious happened because at the time, still the leaders of Matams have this arrangement with the Interior Ministry to control situation. So things don't erupt. But yes, there is, of course, you can expect that neighborhoods that have Matams without population, because in Manama at least, the part of the town is empty. I mean, locals, natives, Bahrainis don't live there. People have moved elsewhere. So they are inhabited by migrants or by non-Muslims. So they probably can demand that matams or processions or that be forbidden. It is probably legal thing that they can process, and the government might accede. We don't know that how the government will react to that. But let me note here that the ruling family, this is something that many Bahrainis don't like what I say. The ruling family uses clerical, Shia clerics. You have Shia turbans in every function than in the royal palace. Not every mullah or sheikh or Shia cleric is against the government. Indeed, they have a lot of them in their camp, in their side of the society. So to be sure, and of course, you have the notables. We have families, large extended families, who have never in their lives sent one prisoner or one arrested person to the in Bahrain. So not all of Shia are against the government. Not the government is not against all Shia. They are against those Shia who are opposed to the government. That's now. Of course, situation the regime, the ruling family is not happy with the forced closeness between mainstream opposition and radical flanks like Wafa, Haq, etc. And they certainly were not happy with Wafaq MPs when they resigned. And this is why they even allowed the process to extend. The parliament did not accept the resignation of the Shia members of parliament or the Wafaq members of parliament until months later. They let it go. The Saudis were in, and I think it was until May or April that they finally accepted the resignation of half the members and then the rest of them. So the government, the regime tries its best to get back what it lost. I mean, with the Intifada, mainly the Wafaq, if they can get them back. They have tried. There are from 2012 until last year, there were several attempts to engage into dialogue with the mainstream opposition. These dialogues were failed dialogues. They were doomed from the start because the regime was asking opposition groups to come back to 2010. And coming back to 2010 is no go for any opposition group. They will lose credibility immediately. So they, I sometimes think that they, it is lack of inventiveness by the regime or arrogance, because they are not offering the moderate opposition any way out from this situation they find them in. And this comes to my answer to General Loca about the constitution. Yes, there they should be, but we, here we go back to 2001. The king actually proposed national action is to build constitutional monarchy on style of reputed Western established democracies. He did not use, he did not say Morocco, he did not say Jordan. It is we, some of us, the opposition, who put in his mouth Jordan, but he meant England. He wanted the constitutional democracy. That's what he said. So the challenge was would, it's not that making a constitutional democracy a state. The challenge is can he afford transforming his members of his family into citizens? It's not to make Abdul Hadi or Ala or General Loca citizens. It is to make Al Khalifa citizens. That is the issue. Without a state in which the ruling family is also citizen, there is a problem with constitutionality. And yes, I think there is a way out. The way out is I live in Sweden, I pay for the and for the Republican Association in Sweden, but I still live in that country. So the problem is not with monarchy. The problem is what type of monarchy. The king cannot afford, simply cannot afford. I feel sympathy for him in this matter. It is not only vested interest within the ruling family. Now you know Bahrain very well. A member of the ruling family gets a salary from day one after his birth, her birth. They get salaries, they get privileges, and of course they are assured of positions immediately after they finished any school. So these privileges can disappear immediately. It is not honor, it is not status, it is actual monetarized privileges, and this he cannot afford unless
he can't afford to eliminate them. Those privileges,
yeah,
right.
So the constitution that eliminates this, well, now do we have that? No, I raise a slogan when I speak in Bahrain. I say this regime cannot be reformed from within. Now, reforms can be imposed by revolt, by repeated rebellions, by uprisings, etc., or by mentors of this regime, benefactors of this regime, including Britain and the United States and others, and Iran, of course, that they come together. This regime is a troublemaker. You have to reform it yourself in order that you don't rock the Gulf boat. The second problem that the king has is of course the neighboring countries. You have Saudi Arabia. I mean, would they they didn't accept 1973 Meek Parliament. We had very limited mandate. Still, Saudi Arabia did not accept it. And they are doing their best to undermine the Kuwaiti parliament. So the would they accept also stripping the royal family? That because this is, might be contagious. Stripping the Al-Khalifa might be contagious to Saudi Arabia, might be contagious to other Al-Zayed. Can one say something against Al-Zayed here?
You can say whatever you like.
Okay.
We welcome critical speech.
Against all these, there's a problem. The problem is that we have to reform, I think, the one who sells the arms, who benefits from these regimes. The Al-Khalifa privileges can survive as long as we are prepared to sell weapons to them, and because we are dependent on our relations, our commercial relations to them.
Okay. So, yes.
Do you want to talk about my university of Mexico? One of the elements which has led lack of legitimacy of the regime, which also has made difference of Bahraini regime from other Gulf nations, is that it's the Khalifa regime, or Khalifa Bailey, is not from indigenous population. And to me, it seems this is the main source of contentious nature of Bahrain, rather than sectarian divide, which has been used and manipulated by the regime. So how do you see this explanation?
Okay.
Should we say, take a few others? Well, I'm going to see if I'm, because I know there are some who've already spoken who want to speak, but I was going to wait to, if there's anyone else. Okay, well, maybe we'll just answer this one. And we will come back to, there's so a couple of people there.
You raise an important issue. This is, on the one hand, the conquest, al-fath, is a basis for the regime's legitimacy. The regime, the ruling family, sees itself as legitimate because of the conquest. And on the other hand, it is based for its illegitimacy because the population sees it as a conqueror. Now, you would have thought that the narratives of conquest would have disappeared in order that the king rebuild a country, build a nation, or build them. Now, you know the story, of course, that they came from Zabara on the coast of Qatar. The king's inventive solution was, actually he said it, we all came from Zabara, Shia and Sunni, to Bahrain. So his solution was that Bahrain was empty, and we all came there. So he even rewritten that, but of course it was ridiculous because the story is well documented. The conquest is fascinating story because it goes into details of the social life. It does not only dictate how the conqueror behave. Sometimes you understand why they don't care about the environment, why they have why this sheikh or that did not think about the gardens that were and they simply destroyed every green piece of land in the country to build palaces or to build roads. They are conquerors. They like all conquerors. They are not staying for long, etc. This type of mentality, and of course, it is the right. It was 50 years ago that any sheikh can come to a merchant and say, I want this, and he takes it. 70, 80 years earlier, they can even take their woman. So the conquest is there. The mentality among the conquest. But unfortunately, it is also, like Ibn Khaldun teaches, the conquered also are affected by the conquest. They also learn to obey. They also learn to a pattern of behavior that seeks conflict avoidance. We have that. It permeates everything in our society. So the change that these contingent accelerators did, exactly by being faceless and leaderless, you couldn't shame them, in the same way that we non persons can be shamed.
Right. Okay. So you wanted to come back and then yourself.
Ask question and then I will bring some examples. Do you think seriously that the king has a real intention to bring Bahrain to a constitutional monarchy, serious steps that he's willing to take, considering the royal family, considering the region, whatever? Because that one is not there. Beside the external factor that can influence his ability, then there is no mean on that front. What we have seen in action, the steps that have been taken by the regime is to reset the rules, not to 2010, it's even a way before or pre 2001. The positive steps that have been taken, the king came in, they are revisiting it in a way to legitimize restricting the space that has been given to the people. So all of these are signals that there is no real intention to advance the reform that has been taken, if it has been taken.
I don't disagree.
You agree on the steps, but the intention, is there is a willingness? So do you see a hope that there might be a change on the willingness?
Well, sociologists are very bad predictor of future. We are very bad, but we have evidence from the past. We have evidence from the past that even very hard conservatives can take steps that are liberal. The idea is survival. The regime survival, if regime survival requires reform, they will do it. So now the idea, the trick is for a political activist is how to push a regime to the brink of either this or that. If you give the regime alternatives, I will accept anything you give me, then the regime will not give way. That's the point.
Okay. Right. And here.
The British naval base, does it indicate anything? Is it a return of the British forcefully to the region, as the economists said, we are back last December, and as the foreign secretary here said, that we are now taking charge of the Middle East while America is going to the South, Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And do you think there is, at the moment, under the surface, is there any British Saudi competition? Of course, Iran also on the other side, but and then do you see an element linking, or a thread linking the forces that have caused the collapse of the Arab Spring, or is each country has its own forces that brought its revolution down? I mean, do you see that, for example, Saudis, Emiratis have intervened in Bahrain, intervened in Yemen now, intervened in Egypt? Do you see this counter-revolution in action?
Okay. All right, and let's add a couple. Yeah.
Badr, BLSC. To what extent does the Wahhabi support of Al-Khalifa in the early 1800s against the Al bin Said of Oman reflect the Saudi support of Al-Khalifa against the Bahraini opposition in 2013?
Okay. Right, so how about those three questions?
Okay.
We're keeping you working hard.
Yes. No, and changing hats.
Yes. Yes.
The British, of course, why did they leave 68? Why the East of Suez has come up? It was simply because United States was coming up and was taking over. British Empire was falling down, it was getting bankrupted. And while the new boy in town, the United States, was really taking over. So it was understandable then. The changes that the British base that brought to the scene now is that Britain is still continuing to play its secondary role within the American strategy. It is going to take a more active role to fill a vacuum that the American leave, but within the American overall strategy. I don't see the significance of that. Now, of course, they are the British politicians have accepted what Heath refused in 68. Edward Heath in 68 has refused that offers from Sheikh Zayed, from Khalifa bin Salman of Bahrain, that we will pay for you. Now the British, of course, in Bahrain, they accepted that the Bahraini king is building their base, is financing. So so the it tells you more about the decline of of Britain as a power. Then, and of course, if it sends but it doesn't change the strategy. Bahrain is still small compared to the region. Bahrain is used like it was used in the past 200 years, used as a base for to protect other interests in the Gulf and beyond. It is a tragic, of course, for us, for those who suffer from it, because British officers, British politicians are much more involved in the local affairs than the Americans have been, and they might and they know the details, and they have trained many of the officers belong to the ruling family, so their influences can be politically and financially can be devastating. They, of course, they can convince their cadets or those whom they trained in Britain that this particular pistol is much better, although if we say mold it in gold or in diamond, etc. But they are better. They will be better salesmen. So we will lose. But strategically, we are in the same position. We are in the hand of the United States, which, of course, now by the middle, the whole Gulf might lose its strategic importance or that it has been. in the past, because of the oil, because of the shale, because of several other factors that are coming. Now to the Wahhabi. Now the it is complicated history, and it needs more considerate answer than I can give you now. But I will let you on a story on Sheikh Mohammed bin Khalifa. He was a ruler in 1854, and he had a castle, a fort, with two towers. On one tower was the Iranian flag. On the other tower was the Turkish flag. At the same time, of course, but the British did not like him. So they destroyed that fort and took the ruler, sent the ruler back to India and replaced him with his brother, Sheikh Ali. The story, what I'm telling you from this story is that Bahrain has always been contested, being attractive for rulers, if it is Abu Sa'id or the Iranians or the Wahhabi or the even small tribes in Qatar. They are always, this is a prize for some reason, there is some riches, some strategic position, and it has been attractive. The interesting thing when you look at at Wahhabi-Bahraini relation is that since 1869, when the British brought Isa bin Ali, the predecessor of this king, to rule Bahrain, he was a young man. But the condition, the Al-Khalifa were happy because the British now will protect them from the Wahhabis. The role of Britain for the Al-Khalifa was to push away the Wahhabis. The Wahhabis were the fear that Al-Khalifa lived with all the time. And these are documented in the stories, but it took them it took it until 2001, this story, in spite of what we know of good relations that has occurred with the Saudis. They have intervened in Bahrain in 72, they have sent help in 75, they give the ruling Saudis gave the ruling family half of Abu Sa'afa oil, 150,000 barrels, it is good money, but still the fear was there, and continued until 2001. The king followed the tradition, King Hamad followed the tradition of his ancestors, that I need a foreign protector against the Wahhabis. So he went to Bush, George W. Bush, and they made a good friendship, and Bahrain was considered, together with Israel, etc., strategic non-NATO ally of United States. He went further and signed the first free trade agreement with the United States. That was in direct opposition to the Saudi, who wanted to negotiate free trade agreement with the United States as a collective, as a GCC. He broke the rank. Saudis were furious. They cut the oil. Those 150,000 they were cut. The direct money subsidies that they sent to Bahrain, they were cut. Even their teachers, teaching staff they sent to religious school also were cut. So the king realized was under real burden. He realized that United States is not the best protector from Saudi. Saudis are getting stronger hand, at least as far as he is concerned. So the story is complicated. We need to talk a lot.
You said you weren't going to give a considered answer to that question, but I think you did. But there was this question that went unanswered, the regional versus national dynamics in the Arab uprisings.
The Arab uprising proved, showed once again for all of us that Arabs talk Arabic or speak Arabic. So they learn from each other. The same slogan was, you heard it in Tunis and you heard it in Sana'a. So the Shab, you read the Qatar Nidama, but different content of that slogan. Of course, and we saw that how people influenced each other, learned from each other, and the experiences were exchanged. I saw the ex-president of Tunis when after the Mansour al-Mazouqi, before he became president, going out to the Bahraini embassy and saying down al-Khalifa. Then he of course resigned after he became president. But the point is that we had this link, and For me, as a student of the Middle East, I was happy at least Fuad Ajami was wrong. The end of Arabism is wrong. I mean, we had Arabism, we can, but it is a different type of Arabism. Now, I tried here to show that the process, the way, the trajectory towards the uprising of February 2011 had 10 years span. It did not. It took a lot of frustration. It took a lot of disappointment. It took a lot of imprisonment, etc. But it has its own narrative, its own writers, its own actors, its own participants. But it had the same thing like Tunis, in the sense that people for different reasons became discontent. People for different reasons saw that the alternative to uprising is stagnation and probably death, literally. So they reached a point where they had nothing to lose. With the idea of when you push your people to that we have nothing to lose, then you are real in real danger. And this is what happened in Tunisia, in Egypt, Syria, and in Bahrain and in Yemen. People were pushed to the brink, and they have unfortunately with different results. With different results, and some of them are continuing to be very tragic. But let me say that what we had in 2010 was horrible. We had at least when in Bahrain we had people who were feeling desperate, and they saw that things were meaningless, and there is no way out. Now some of them know that there is a way out. At least when you are hit, you should shout. You should say, you should resist different type of resistance, but you should not accept to be subdued. Which is same in Tunisia. The military in Egypt is strong. The military in the military and the gangs in Syria are strong. but still people are hoping for a way out. Mm. That is different from what it was in 2010.
Yeah.
Emily, I'm from QCL, Center of International Relations. My question is regarding sectarianism as a strategy of the regime during the Arab Spring. How successful was it in dividing the supposedly united population, and what are the prospects for a cross-sectarian future uprising?
Yeah, this is very important question. I'm glad that you used sectarian policies. I don't think the Al-Khalifa regime, the king or anyone, is sectarian by nature. It is sectarian because it serves sectarianism serves purposes. And as I mentioned earlier, many of the strong allies of the ruling family are Shias. And this goes up to 1783. The sheikhs who exploited Shia lands or were not directly involved. They were always using a Shia wazir, a Shia middleman. So it is a history. Sectarianism has increased to a level that it became beneficial for any person. A person is for the poor of the poor. The poorest of the poor benefits now from sectarianism. The less of the other guy, the less other guys, teachers, is good for me. I can get promoted. The less of them in the sweeping floors, then it is better for me. It has become beneficial for everyone. So I don't want to demean the process, but it goes back to the American sociologist who studied the white trash. The white trash in the United States hated the blacks much more than any other white. The white trash, it saw their benefits in suppression of the Negroes, of the black population. The more they are suppressed, it is the better for the white trash. Sectarianism is now runs deep. But this is not only responsibility of the regime. The main opposition groups have also acted in a sectarian way. Let me take, I mentioned the 2010 election. 2010 election, the Lufab, they had its Shia list. In Shia and candidates only in Shia districts, and of course they had the possibility, the chance, the chance to put forward some Sunni in these districts, and they could would have been elected. No, they didn't. The regime has, on the other hand, the regime has pushed its military voters, military and security voters, to vote for Sunni candidates. So from the, you saw that very clearly in 2010 election results. The situation is bad. Now, let me give you how bad it is. The NLF was a communist party. Now it has a different name. It became a legal party. NLF is the communist party is a split between Shia and Sunni. That's how bad it is.
Now. The NLF.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is how bad it is.
Shia communist Sunni communists.
No, I mean they don't. They don't call themselves that way. But it is
that's
this.
We even like anecdotally, we can even sort of observe like communist Shia communist balls and Shia communist as well. Sunni communist balls in Bahrain as well, as you know, places where these Sunni and leftist communists get together and sort of have their own.
No, but I mean, let us not be a discussion on communism now. But the idea is that the regime benefits from when as a student of social development in Bahrain, you would have noticed that the regime has always preferred to maintain vertical segmentation of society. These villages are like that, Shia are like that, not all Shia together. The Shia of this village get segmented against the Shia of the next village. That was what they, and they still do that. Within the sectarian narrative, please note, that this can segmentation continue even within that. So the Shia villages can be segmented vertically, supporters of the regime and supporters of those who get the makramas, those who don't. Same with the Sunni villages, same with the Sunni districts. So the it is not quiet. It is only 750,000. The whole country, probably with it is 1.3, including the foreigners. But it is very complicated because you have with the segmentation, you have any type of, probably have red hair Shia, black hair Shia, something like that. How segmentation is taking place is fascinating. And when you have rent to finance segmentation, then you put the patron over any segment, and then through the patron you disperse your makramas.
Yeah.
Well, the future, I don't see it coming. To bridge the gap between the sectarian gap requires a lot of inventive politics from the opposition. Inventive in that sense that in the sense that it might even endanger the cohesion of the opposition, because that will go against among established traditions, established histories.
Can I push you a bit then on again the explanation for the uprising in early 2011, because as you said, there was a major opposition party that was accepting the status quo and had won an election victory. Their formidable means of repression at the hands of the state. There is long-standing usage of different kinds of makrama and sectarianism. Then you have the rents business, and I mean, I was struck by a conference on Algeria that I went to, where it became clear that, you know, you have all these socio-economic protests that went on in Algeria through 2011. They never became political in the sense of saying we call for the fall of the regime. There was a sort of different offerings. That there was an anthropologist at this conference who said the Algerians were simply, you know, we had our Arab uprising, it happened in 91 too, it ended in a horrible civil war, and but if we protest on socio-economic issues, we get some kind of provision. But it became clear also the extent of rentier provision in Algeria. So, but in that case, it, according to these findings and papers, it worked. So it is very striking, as you say, that there's something malfunctioning in the rentier provision in Bahrain. I mean, in view of the long history of how it has operated. But the explanation, as I understand it, then in the face of this, the
the inability of the ruling bloc to engage in meaningful reform then feeds into a situation where radical Franks and contingent accelerators can generate a situation where there's a real uprising. It brings together the diverse sectors of the population. I mean, is there an explanatory gap somewhere? I mean, in the case of Algeria, what was striking was that the history of activism was read as having gone into a dead end in 92. I mean, Bahrain is striking for its history of activism, which is not just pessimist. Maybe it's a bit more optimistic. I mean, they have had organizations. They have had continuous politicized forms, you know, through the 50s, in the 70s, again, all through the 90s. Is there something in that history of organization and protest that is, because Bahrain is distinctive. I mean, it has a mass uprising in 2011. Only Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, Libya, Syria, but also Bahrain. Again, one of the only rentiers to have such an uprising. So, have you fully explained all of that?
No. I simply not easy to do that. But let me try now when I have a few minutes. Now, what is the difference between the ruling clique in Algeria and the ruling family in Bahrain? The difference is that in Bahrain, the demography is different. The ruling family expands something like 3% per year. I mean, natural.
Right.
And their health is quite good. They survive. So the numbers is in the increase. The resources are limited. You still, whatever you do, the Bahrain is how much, whatever you get from Saudi Arabia, they get the oil and the oil produced in Bahrain or refined in Bahrain, they get some what I call strategic rent, because whenever they have security trouble, it's United Arab Emirates sends a few hundred millions, Kuwait sends a few tens of millions. This, when sometimes the opposition serves the regime by providing it with arguments for begging more support from the neighbors. Mm-hmm. Now, this is one main difference. The second main difference is that the military in Algeria invest their rent in businesses, while our ruling family is conspicuous consumption, is a consumer, is a spender. They buy flats here or castles there, but they don't own factories like the Algerian junta, military junta. So these are two important differences, the demography and the type of investment, and of course the limited resources. The land grab has provided the ruling family with something in Bahrain to increase the resources, the financial resources. But as it appears that the money accrued from land grab and from security rent is consumed by the ruling family most of the time. And in recent year now, we have the debates is for taxing the citizens, imposing new taxes, charges, eliminating subsidies. They have already started with subsidies on basic stuffs, meat, rice, the oil, gas, and and oil will be will come soon. They are imposing taxes now, charges on basic services that were free of charge before. So the rentier as such now is the even government spokespersons speak about the end of rentiers. That is the, and this is something something new. But mind you, it is not because of lack of resources, it is because resources are spent within the ruling family. Something the British were better at. The British, when they administered Bahrain, they imposed this rule. 1/3 of the income goes to the ruling family, 1/3 of the income goes to reserve funds, and 1/3 goes to services. After independence, we didn't see that that line disappeared. When King Hamad came, he eliminated the royal expenses from the budget. Now we don't know, no one knows how much is budgeted for the how much is spent by the military, by the security, and or by the royal palace. Is out of it. So the how much of that is that's my answer to comparing a big country like Algeria with a small country like Bahrain.
Okay, well, super. Well, you know, I think that was a treat. And, I think we'll have to carry on outside because we're sort of out of time. I mean, it's not often you get someone with such a great knowledge of the country and combined with a historical and sociological view and in the study of protest, which is often done in a too sort of shallow and ahistorical and asociological way. So I thought that was a treat. I'm delighted to see so many people here, and I hope you found it a rich discussion. Can I just mention there's another lecture in the Middle East Center tomorrow at 6 p.m. Dina Esfandiari of King's College London will discuss who makes foreign policy decisions in Iran and Iran's regional policy. I'd also like to mention the next meeting of this seminar series is coming up next term, and it's going to be Hamad Choukri speaking about Tunisia, and he's based in France. So look out for that next term. And please, if you want to join the mailing list, which also gets a digest every 2 weeks on everything to do with social movements and popular mobilization in the Middle East and North Africa, events, publications, panels, opportunities, and so on, please send me an email and I will put you on the list. Abdul Hadi Khalaf has a contribution in an edited volume which is outside on sale, and it's terrific. It's called Bahrain's Uprising. It's edited by Ala Shahabi, who's sitting over there, and also Mark Owen Jones, and it's on sale at a discounted price outside, £14, so you save £4 if you buy it from us this afternoon. Is that right, Sandra? Yeah, so, you know, that's not rentier or patronage politics, that's just sort of discounts and things. But, so thank you very much for coming, and above all, thank you very much to the speaker.